impressive voice of Minnesota. It's Brett with you on a Thursday afternoon. Today's show is pre-recorded, but do have two interviews lined up for you. As coming up later on in the show, we're going to be speaking with Max Richmond of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, because unfortunately, there is some bipartisan support for some possible cuts that could happen to both Social Security and Medicare through Congress. And yeah, hard to believe, bipartisan support for some possible cuts to both of those programs. And by the way, the politicians are actually going to be doing this in a way where they don't necessarily even leave their fingerprints on those potential cuts. So we're going to be speaking about that with Max coming up later on in the show, as well as some changes to Social Security payments too. And then also want to preview what's happening on tomorrow's show, because that's going to be pre-recorded as well, but it is, as always, brand new to you content. We're going to be speaking with Aaron Brown of Minnesota Brown about the state of politics in northern Minnesota, because if the DFL wants any sort of shot at retaking the state Senate, well, they're going to have to be able to win a couple of those state Senate seats on the Iron Range and in the Duluth area. So we'll talk with Aaron Brown of Minnesota Brown about that and whether the DFL actually has a chance at picking up a couple of seats. We're also on Friday going to be speaking with Didi Guttenplan of The Nation magazine, as he recently wrote a piece talking about why Labour had such a lack of success in the British elections, and talking about whether we could actually draw any parallels to what could be happening in 2020 with our own elections. But first, I want to talk about a labor issue that is affecting a number of nursing assistants at Twin Cities hospitals. And this is very important because nursing assistants are typically the first people you run into when you or a loved one or a family member or a friend end up at the hospital. And they are making some demands for better wages and better work conditions. So we're going to be playing back my interview with Eric, who is a nursing assistant here in the Twin Cities, to get his thoughts on what's been happening. So happy to be joined now by Eric Bassey. He is a nursing assistant here in the Twin Cities, as recently nursing assistants in the Twin Cities who are members of the SEIU union have delivered petitions asking for a 5% increase to the leadership of 8 Twin Cities hospitals. They've asked for a wage increase on the basis of the long hours that they work and the low pay in comparison to other area hospitals. So Eric, thanks so much for joining us on the program today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Brett. It's a pleasure to having you, a long-time listener. The issues at hand right now has been very much a sticking point in the delivery of good quality care as far as the nursing assistants are concerned. We have been in a situation where every other aspect of the hospitals has been upgraded, systems upgraded, remodeling, and everything upgraded except the wages of the workers, which is still more or less left in the very low aspect of wages that you can compare any other place. For instance, I would want to say $15 right now to somebody who work in a 100 hospital that has been named among the 100 hospitals in the world recognized. I mean, it's nothing to write home about. You have to work long hours, do a double shift. Number one, this compromises patient safety. Number two, you are prone to all kinds of injuries, which does occur. We are looking for a situation where we can have a living wage, where members, can at least be able to work a full time without taking on the extra burden of working extra hours in order to be able to meet their house rent. A situation where you have the CEO's compensation, every other person's been adjusted to reflect the economic situation right now. And that of the nursing assistant, the least among them, is being left in the dust for the past 5 or 10 years. This situation is not acceptable. Members cannot be made to face this kind of hardship while the hospital is being recognized in all kinds of ways because of the input and the labors of the nursing assistant.
Oh, absolutely.
We hear every day that it's a teamwork from the CEO to the doctors to the nurses and then the nursing assistant. Okay, if it's a teamwork, how come every other person gets what they need, adjustments in terms of living wage, and not the nursing assistant, the least among them? We would, every year we get messages from the CEO recognizing and wishing everybody well as far as Christmas is concerned, New Year is concerned, and Easter is concerned, or Thanksgiving is concerned. But you see, we, at the end of the food chain, when we receive this message, it's a different experience. It's a different a reality for us, because this message does not reflect the situation we are in right now. You cannot tell us everything is good. Meanwhile, we are suffering. We expect them to do the right thing. Some Twin Cities hospitals have been able to adjust their wages. Some are paying $18 and up, which reflects the fact that the duties of a nursing assistant is not as simple as it used to be. In fact, most of the researches that are done by the doctors are passed down to the nursing assistant too for continuity of care. That is how important this role is. I cannot imagine that they will sit on the wages of the nursing assistant for the past 5 to 10 years and they are still paying less than minimum wage. It's unthinkable. And it's not something that I think we should be able to argue with them about and let other parties be involved. We are asking them to do the right thing. You know, we are in the business of caring for people. We are in the business of taking care of broken bones and mending our wounds. I expect a level of compassion from the leadership of all these Twin Cities hospitals, especially Park Nicolet and Methodist Hospital.
So, Eric, as I sit here and think about this as well, when someone ends up in the hospital in an unfortunate situation, they're primarily going to be interacting with nursing assistants, not so much the doctors. So
absolutely,
you guys are definitely on the front line. And if I'm sitting there as a patient, I want someone caring for me that's actually getting a livable wage, that's not under a ton of stress, that's happy with their job.
It is the thing is, sometimes it is the nursing assistant that is the face the person sees when they comes in first. Because the moment you get into the emergency, or maybe you just come to the hospital on admission, you have to see somebody first. Most likely you see the nursing assistant first. And when you leave, when you are discharged, the last person you see is the nursing assistant who helps you to your car. We are talking about a situation, we are not just looking at maybe a bedside manner and bedside care. We do other things, we do transportation, we do all kind manner of things to make sure that the well-being of the patient from the moment he steps into the hospital and the moment he leaves is well taken care of. These are some of the things that, you know, you cannot quantify it, but it is the last experience of the patient that matters most, the impression he has, you know. Mm-hmm. When you wheel a patient who is being discharged from his room, you make sure he is well situated. You take him from his room to the ramp to the car, and you make sure he's in the car and drives up. Then your job is done. That I don't think is a 14 or $15 job. And most people who do that and who live around the environment, they can't even pay their rent. It's a shame.
Yeah.
I expect the hospitals to do more.
Yeah,
because the job of the nursing assistant has become even more sophisticated every day.
And talk about how that has become more sophisticated over the years, because it sounds like you guys have had a lot more responsibilities added to your job over the years.
Most nursing duties in terms of we are able to monitor output. We are able to look at the patient and look at changes, and look at any a change of consciousness, and anything that we observe, we are able to report immediately. Change of consciousness, status, and everything. And we are also able to, you know, it's like you talk about the use of technology. Most nursing assistants have been teletrained. That means they are able to apply telepatches to a patient's heart, monitor the heart, and also set it up so that the nurses can see it, the doctors can see it. I mean, the job has become a little bit more sophisticated than it is, you know. And so many other things, you have nursing assistants in the children's ward, the nursing assistants in the delivery rooms. You have nursing assistants, actually monitoring a children's heart rate, heart pressure, standing right there just to report immediately if they see any changes. And this, this is a very specialized area. The doctor cannot be there at that point. The nurse cannot be there at that point. It is the nursing assistant, input from the nursing assistant, that generates this flow that moves up and for intervention to be done right away. You know, so I don't understand it.
Sure.
What happens is they have left this situation to slide for a very, very long time. I think it's time for the hospital management to recognize the fact that there are partners in the nursing assistant who are actually getting the job done with them as partners, not just people who are more or less like, we are part of the team.
Mm-hmm. So looking at the reaction from the hospitals, they've brought up that, well, you guys and the SEIU negotiated your contract and the current agreement does not expire until February of 2021. So how do you react to the hospital and what they're saying in response to you guys making your demands?
They can react. They can say they live by the contract, which is okay. But you see, the reality of the fact that they come up with new changes and new things, if they are going to react to changes, they react to changes without waiting for contract. Okay? This is a change that they have to react to because, number one, it borders on patient safety. When you make your workers do double overtime over a period, an extended period of time, number one, it leads to injuries. Number two, you are at the point in time, you are going to compromise patient care. So if they don't react to this on time and change this trajectory, which is not sustainable, they can say anything they want about the contract. We know what happens in the unions all over the whole United States, how the unions have been suppressed, and even when they are not outrightly suppressed and disbanded, we know that most are being planted by management who are sitting in as union leaders and suppressing the wishes and aspirations of the people, the union members who are actually paying the money. So we just want them to be responsible. They claim to be responsible to the environment and their community. We want them to be responsible internally. Those are external environment, their community, the people they relate with, and the rest of them. They project a good picture, but actually the team members who are working with them don't feel the same kind of responsibility from their part. We want them to show that same kind of responsibility they project to the public. Let them do it internally, and then we can work together as a team.
So what are the next steps going to be in the process for you guys as nursing assistants in trying to, well, get your wage increases and getting better working conditions? What are some of the next steps you guys are thinking about doing?
We are going to appeal to their good conscience to see exactly what it is, and we'll let them know, because sometimes when you keep quiet, it's like everything is okay. It is not okay. A nursing assistant, some of the nursing assistants in the hospital are graduates. They are 4-year degree holders, and some have other skills that they bring to the table, makes the job easier and adds value to whatever it is that they are trying to do. The hospitals know this. We expect them to respond appropriately in this changing environment. They have a very sophisticated system that needs to work continually, and then, for all hands to be on deck at the same time. We don't want a situation where we have to drag this situation and make it come to a point where we will be forced to withhold our services for a period of time. We know those who are going to be impacted. It is the patients. We don't want this to get to that. We have had a good relationship, and we want them to respond to that.
So what are you hoping folks can do in terms of supporting you guys? Have you received some support from the general public or other unions? What are you hoping people can do to help you out so you guys can receive your better work conditions and better wages?
We would like the public to at least chime in on this and let them know that, hey, they have human beings who are working with them. And not only that, the nursing assistants you have today are responsible members of the society, people who have families, children in school and everything. If you have to work as a nursing assistant, you do your normal maybe 8 days or 9 days in 2 weeks. Honestly, you cannot pay your rent in today's Minnesota. Yeah. They are aware of this. We want them to respond to this.
Absolutely. And I'm just thinking how sad that is, that these are people who are caring for you when you're at your most vulnerable time, or maybe you have a loved one or a family member or a friend that's in the hospital. These are the people you're going to be interacting with a lot. And as you brought up, it's really a case of fairness in terms of, well, not just what other nursing assistants are being paid at other hospitals, but as you brought up as well, kind of that disconnect with management, with the fact that, yeah, well, they're definitely living okay, at least in their aspect, and they're receiving wages that are increasing every year. So there certainly is a big disconnect there with management as well.
There is, because when you tie a cost of living and a wage increase to negotiated a contract that has been done 5 years ago, we know what happens today. We know how things change. I can tell you, in my apartment where I live in a one-bedroom apartment, there has been increase in the rent. Every year I sign the lease, there is a 50% increase. I mean, there is a $50 increase in the rent every year. And this, I'm saying, is not just something that is in the metro, it's all over the whole place. And this is aspect of things that, you know, makes a life very, very difficult. We cannot fight the operators of the apartments or the landlords from increasing their rent. But the situation is becoming untenable. If you cannot pay your rent for 1 month, we know what happens. You are on the street, you become homeless. Mm-hmm. If you miss one payment, you become homeless. So we would like the management at least to look at some of these scenarios and see that the environment and the situation has changed and respond to it appropriately.
And one more question for you, Eric. What hospitals are these that you guys are working at that are represented by your union? Which hospitals, one more time, are these?
We look at Children's Hospital. We look at Park Nicolette Methodist Hospital and Regions and all the rest in the Twin Cities areas and beyond in Minnesota.
Gotcha. All right. Hey, Eric Bassey, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program today. Again, Eric is a nursing assistant that's been a long time a nursing assistant here in the Twin Cities as they're working to get better wages and better work conditions at area hospitals. Eric, thanks so much for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me, Brett. It's a pleasure talking to you.
And by the way, a great resource to follow along what's happening with those nursing assistants of the Twin Cities is the SEIU Minnesota Twitter account. You can follow them at SEIUMN on Twitter. Coming up next, we'll be speaking with Max Richman of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, talking about some potential cuts that we could be seeing through executive action by the Trump administration, as well as some bills that have made their way through Congress that actually have bipartisan support. We'll talk with Max about that up next.
From the sky, no blood soaked the ground. No powder flash blinded the eye. No deadly.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's Brett with you here on a Thursday afternoon. We're joined now by Max Richman. He is with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare because, well, with both of those topics, Social Security and Medicare, there are some proposed changes that are making their way through Congress and also by executive action of the Trump administration. So happy to welcome Max to the program now. Max, how you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for the invitation to be on your show.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's certainly some important topics to cover, and one of them is something I briefly talked about earlier in the weekend. It's basically a proposed change by the Trump administration that could end disability benefits for a number of disabled people who are actually on Social Security right now and getting Social Security income. Because currently, as I understand it, and Max, do correct me if I'm wrong, beneficiaries are basically placed in three categories based on the severity of their disability, which is medical improvement not expected, medical improvement expected, and medical improvement possible. But there is a new category being proposed by the administration called medical improvement likely, which would subject beneficiaries to even more frequent reviews than they already are subjected to. So, Max, do I kind of have that right on the changes?
Well, you've done your homework. You've got it exactly right. In fact, exactly 1 month ago today, on November 18th, the Social Security Administration issued and published a notice of proposed rulemaking. This means that it's open for a comment period until the end of January. So at that point, we'll see if it survives, but we've got an opportunity to comment, and you can be sure that the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare will submit comments. Basically, this new regulation, this new proposed rule would establish, as you said, a new an additional classification for review under the continuing disability review process, and that is, as you noted, something called medical recovery likely. This addition to the three that already exist, the three categories and classifications that exist, would in effect mean that an additional a little over 2.5 million reviews will be conducted over the next 10 years, over 200,000 a year. Those people that are selected additionally under beyond what is the current status, the government claims will prevent about $2 billion in erroneous payments, disability payments. What we're concerned about, and I think it's what you're concerned about as well, is, you know, we do support the Social Security Disability Program, maintaining its integrity, making the best use of Social Security resources, and we also want to make sure that the public is being fairly looked out for. And these activities that the proposal is going to be conducting in these reviews, we're hoping, and we will comment on this, will be conducted in a humane and caring way. I'm not sure that's where it's going, but we need to do whatever we can to impress upon the Social Security Administration that by adding this category with the goal of saving $2 billion over 10 years, they do need to take into consideration whether these individuals really are deserving of support under the disability program.
And to me, as I look at this, this kind of seems like a solution in search of a problem, because as I already have a few friends that are on SS benefits, Social Security benefits, and the review process already is pretty stringent. I know they usually have quite a bit of stress, unfortunately, when they go through this entire review process. So to me, this doesn't really seem like necessarily the best idea, because as I said, it seems like a solution in search of a problem.
Well, I think that's a very good way to characterize it. The process is already onerous. You know, we have testified in the past before the Congress about the length of time it takes to get a disability claim processed, and if by some chance, and only a small portion are approved, if by some chance the ones that are not approved are appealed, that could take several years. There are people dying waiting for the review process to take place and to culminate in a decision. We ran across an individual in doing our research that had been waiting nearly 700 days for a hearing. And that's just not acceptable. So
700 days? My goodness, that's over, what, that's close to 2 years, isn't that? Wow.
It's close to 2 years for a hearing.
Just a hearing, wow.
And then to determine whether the disability was legitimate and should be taken care of with support from the Social Security program. This is why, you know, I'm so glad you focused on this in your show and your previous show, as I understand it, earlier this month. We think it's absolutely essential that the Social Security Administration handles these new reviews, these continuing disability reviews, which are being expanded by this proposed rulemaking to look at more cases. with real care, with compassion, and that they provide the kind of assistance that is called for those people that are going to have to undergo this review. You know, these are some of the most vulnerable Americans in our society, and they already have challenges just, you know, getting out of bed, going to the bathroom, and to propose additional challenges that this process is looking at. We've got to make sure that any final conclusions are, first of all, developed on a complete and thorough examination of whatever medical files exist, and not make this process so onerous that people will not be able to get the support they need, or, as I said, they'll die before they do get that support.
Exactly, and yeah, no one's exactly getting rich collecting Social Security payments anyways. I mean, I have a buddy of mine who talks about how he's limited to $2,000 in his account, because if he goes above that, then he loses his benefits.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're part of a coalition here in Washington. It's called the Consortium of Citizens with Disabilities, and we'll be working with that within that coalition to do everything we can in our comments between now and the end of January to make sure that any new reviews are conducted in a humane way and in a thorough way, and hopefully will not lead to denials of those people who really need help.
So let's talk about some of the people who possibly could lose their benefits, because as you might look at this on the surface, if someone's looking or listening to this out here, they'll say, all right, well, this new category is called medical improvement likely. So in theory, it shouldn't be really touching people who are necessarily, you know, who have lifelong disabilities or permanent disabilities. But unfortunately, that might not always be the case, as there could be children who could be exposed to this, or also people that, as I was reading through in the news, Step 5 recipients. If you can talk about that and some of the other folks who are going to be affected
right.
by
well,
this.
Right. Well, you know, it's actually the category is medical recovery likely.
Gotcha. Okay.
MIL. The other ones that exist now, that's the additional one, are medical recovery expected, MIE, mm-hmm. medical improvement possible, MIP is the acronym, and medical improvement not expected, which is the final category. So, you know, the issue here really is, I hope it doesn't become so subjective that people that a determination is made that medical recovery is likely when that's not in the cards. And since that's really why when I, a little while ago when I talked about making sure that any reviews and any final conclusions are based on fully developed medical files and take into account the fact that so many of these people are really, they're not equipped physically, emotionally, to deal with additional burdens that these reviews will require. And their situation needs to be taken into account. This may be a matter of numbers for the budget people here in Washington, but it's really, as you know, a matter of life and death for people in these situations.
And as I look at this as well, I mean, if someone's sitting there thinking, well, I'm not disabled, I'm not going to be affected by this, to me, this could also be very much a slippery slope down other benefit cuts to Social Security, which, by the way, pretty much everyone is entitled to since we're paying into that in our entire lives.
Right. You know, it's a good point. You know, I listen to your explanation that people are entitled to it. I prefer that it's a benefit, Social Security, that they earned.
Yeah, that's a better way to put it, right.
I think it's important to the language around these things, whether you're talking about the slippery slope you were just talking about or the way Social Security is characterized is really important. And it is, as I'm sure you know, a program that people pay into with every paycheck they have withholding, and that money is there in the event that someone in the family becomes disabled and needs help. The wage earner dies, and there are benefits for survivors, you know, spouses, children. Millions of children get by because of Social Security survivor benefits, or when they do retire, whatever their retirement age may be. So it's an earned benefit, and we've been doing our best whenever we have the opportunity, like I have now on your program, to get that word out. Let's call it an earned benefit. It's harder to make the argument that it needs to be reduced or denied when it is something that's been earned through every withholding of the FICA tax with every paycheck.
And that was part one of our conversation with Max Richman of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Coming up on the other side of the break, we're going to talk about these budget agreements that made their way through Congress, because they are certainly going to have an effect on both Social Security and Medicare. So stay tuned. We'll talk about that up next with Max. You're listening to AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Let's get back to our conversation now with Max Richman of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, as we're now going to be talking about some of these budget agreements that have made their way through Congress because, unfortunately, they do have some negative effects on both Social Security and Medicare. So here's part two of my conversation with Max. We're speaking with Max Richman. He's with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. So, Max, I want to move on to another topic that I saw you guys highlighting through some of your press releases, and that is the Bipartisan Congressional Budget Reform Act, which would make changes to the way Congress implements budgets, where if enacted, the bill would establish a fast-track reconciliation process, which would lead to possibly some deep cuts in Medicare, Medicaid, the ACA, health insurance subsidies. I think even Social Security could be affected by this. So can you talk about what exactly this bill does? Again, it's called the Bipartisan Congressional Budget Reform Act.
Right. This is a bill that Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island has been pursuing. He has some Republican co-sponsors. I believe one of them is Senator Enzi. But it is a proposal to fast track budget resolution of budget issues, and we've been down that track before, and it fortunately we have been able to avoid acceptance of using that fast track process, because what it essentially does is as I see it, make it easier for the Congress to cut the programs like Medicare, Medicaid, Older Americans Act, things that are so important to so many people, Meals on Wheels, low-income energy assistance programs to help people stay warm in the winter. It's very important up where you are, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and this would be a way to short-circuit the normal process of hearings, votes, and committees, and ram through some reductions in funding for these programs. And I think some of the proponents of this process, I think the thing that's so appealing about it is they won't have their fingerprints on it. It'll be, some of this will be done through, it'll be almost automatic. And I think it's important that if members of Congress are going to cut programs that are so important to their constituents, they be accountable for it, and they go through the regular process. So we have put out a very strong, you've probably seen it, press release in opposition to that proposal. And you know, I'm hoping it doesn't go anywhere. I said this is, as I said before, that this has been tried a couple of different times over the last 8 or 10 years, and in one instance, the effort failed by one vote over in the of a House member. So you know, this is this is going to be a challenge for us as we get into the next session of the, of this Congress.
And something you brought up at the beginning is that obviously it would seem like, yeah, Republicans would be in favor of this, but there are some Democrats who are supporting this as well, as I believe you said Sheldon Whitehouse is also on board with this, correct?
Correct.
Wow, yeah. So yeah, it's got, unfortunately, some bipartisan support. And as yes. I was kind
and
of...
There are, there are Democrats and Republicans supporting it in a companion that's been introduced in the House. This has just happened very recently, so... You know, I'm pretty confident that we can derail it, but it's something we have to keep our eye on and focus our energy on.
And as I read through some of the language in here that you were talking about in the press release and also in the bill, it seems like it could make cuts to these programs at some really bad times. Not that there's really ever a good time to cut Social Security and Medicare and other programs, but this could be especially affected if we have an economic downturn or a recession.
Right, exactly. You know, some of these changes would be virtually automatic, and would under the normal budgeting process, members of Congress could take into account economic circumstances like a recession. I mean, the worst time to make these kinds of reductions in these types of federal programs are when people are hurting in a recession. So there are so many reasons that make sense to oppose this, and I think we'll get a lot of support from our allies, both in the House and the Senate, as this moves along, and if there are any hearings on the proposal.
So one final topic I want to touch on with you here, Max, and this is the overall bipartisan budget deal we saw from a few days ago that's going to avert a government shutdown, because it's being perceived as a win for both sides of the aisle. But as I kind of take a deeper look at this budget agreement, it seems like there are some real problematic provisions, including repeals on the medical device tax, also the health insurance tax, and I think importantly, too, there was nothing done about surprise medical bills that was, well, supposed to be in that bill, but ended up not making it in. So can you talk about at least what your thoughts are on this?
Well, all those points you raise are legitimate. We would agree with the positions that you've taken and what you just said. On top of that, we were hoping that the Social Security program would have additional funds appropriated to run the program, and there have been cuts to Social Security for probably 8 to 10 years. I'm talking about not the benefits, the administration operation of the program, and we really needed to have about $300 million added to the program to just barely keep up with inflation. That is not part of this budget deal. And as a result, what are you going to see? You're going to see more, fewer staff. You're going to see longer lines for people that need to get information. If you want to call that 800 number to get help with your benefits or a claim, you're going to be on hold forever. I think it's gone up to about 40 minutes to be on hold. Most people are going to hang up. So the thing that's so upsetting about the lack of funding for the Social Security Administrative budget is that most of this money comes out of the payroll tax. The FICA tax that employees and employers pay every paycheck is used to pay the benefits and also used to run the program. So, you know, when you're paying payroll tax, when you're paying your FICA tax, you are expecting to get the benefits that are designed for you as a retiree or someone who becomes disabled, or survivor benefits are at play, and you're expecting to have the service that the program should be providing, since you're paying for that anyway out of your payroll tax, and that is not the case. The Social Security program administrative budget has not kept pace with inflation by a long shot, and it's disappointing to see that in this budget deal that hasn't been fixed.
Max, I know you got to get running in a few minutes here, but really appreciate you taking some time to join us today. Again, that's Max Richman. He's with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. By the way, you can learn more information about them at ncpssm.org. Hey, Max, thanks so much for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Brett.
And again, do encourage you to check out the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, because they do a really nice job tracking what's happening to those benefits that we have earned, as Max said, over the years. You can learn more about that, ncpssm.org. One more segment of the show coming up next. Listening to AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett with you on the 4 o'clock show, final segment of the program. And do want to give you a heads up on what's coming up for tomorrow's show. Coming up, we're going to be speaking with Aaron Brown of Minnesota Brown, talking about the state of politics in northern Minnesota. We're going to be talking about the state Senate races that are taking place on the Iron Range and the Duluth area, because basically if the DFL wants any sort of shot at being able to retake the state Senate, they're probably going to have to win at least a couple of those seats. And we'll also be touching on the race in the 8th Congressional District to see whether Quinn Nystrom or other DFLers possibly have a chance of knocking off Pete Stauber in that 2020 race for the 8th Congressional District. Also, we will be speaking with Dee Dee Guttenplan of The Nation magazine, as we're going to be talking about the British elections that took place last week, because we're hearing this narrative in the corporate media that conservatives did so well in the British elections last week, it could mean that Trump was also going to do well in 2020 here in the States if Democrats nominate an extreme progressive, very much using extreme and progressive in quotes. But we're going to talk about whether that's actually true and whether we can draw parallels between what happened in the British elections last week to what could happen in the States here in 2020. So both of those interviews will be on tomorrow's program. Stay tuned for those. Like on the screen, we all heard how it sounded.